NASCAR on Prime is gearing up for the Tricky Triangle at Pocono. After 5 decades of racing tradition, it's clear that strategy is king at Pocono. 3 legendary turns, 3 unique approaches. Who will tame the triangle this year? Don't miss the Cup Series at Pocono, streaming today at 1 p.m. Eastern. NASCAR, it's on Prime.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get 2 select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Story 1. I never thought I'd experience anything like it in my life. But looking back, I can't shake the feeling that something was there. Something that shouldn't have been. My name's Ryan, and I used to work as an EMT for a few small towns in northeastern Colorado. My brother Eric was a deputy sheriff at the time. He'd often have late shifts, and I'd occasionally tag along during my downtime, riding shotgun while waiting for a call. We worked in a place where there were more cows than people, and the town of Amherst was about as small as it gets. Barely 50 people, a church, some scattered houses, a grain tower, and a park. That's about it. If you blinked, you'd miss it. It was a cold night in early October, the kind of night where the wind is so sharp it feels like needles on your face, the kind of night when every sound feels amplified, like the rustle of leaves or the distant hoot of an owl. We'd already been on patrol for hours, nothing but the usual quiet roads and empty streets, the kind of shift where you start talking about everything under the sun just to keep from nodding off. It was about 3 a.m. when we decided to do one last check through town. The streets were deserted, of course. Amherst doesn't get many visitors at night, especially not at this hour. We turned onto the dirt road that led to the park. I remember looking out of the window, the headlights cutting through the darkness. The park was barely visible, just shadows in the distance. Eric slowed the car, and that's when we saw it. Movement, just a flicker in the dark. My stomach dropped. "Do you see that?" I whispered, more to myself than to Eric. "Yeah," he muttered, pulling over to the side of the road. We both stared at the park, trying to make sense of what we were seeing. There was something out there, some sort of shape, but the darkness made it hard to tell. We sat there for a few seconds, the engine idling. The only sound was the low hum of the patrol car. Then Eric flipped on the spotlight. It scanned the park, the beam of light sweeping across the swings and the nearby play structures, like a giant flashlight cutting through the night. The light stopped, right on the swing set. At first, it didn't make sense. There, sitting on the swing, was a girl, a young girl, maybe 13, I'd guess. She was facing away from us, staring down at the ground, her dark hair falling in front of her face. She didn't move. She didn't react to the light. Nothing. Just sitting there. "Hey," I called out through the PA system, my voice echoing over the park. "Are you all right?" No response, not even a twitch. We both exchanged a look, one of those looks where you realize something's off, but neither of us wanted to say it out loud. Eric's hand hovered over the wheel, but neither of us moved. There was something so wrong about the stillness, about her posture, about how she didn't even flinch at the light. "I don't like this," I said, trying to break the silence. "We should get her attention, see if she's okay." Eric didn't say anything at first. He just nodded, a silent agreement. He picked up the microphone and spoke into it. "Hey, kid, are you lost?" Still nothing. Not a single sound from her. It was like she wasn't even there. I felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Something was wrong. Something was very wrong. "She should have at least reacted," I said, my voice low. "Maybe we should..." Before I could finish the sentence, something happened. The girl who had been sitting completely still was suddenly gone, just like that. 1 second she was there, her small figure hunched over on the swing, and the next, nothing. The park was completely empty, no sound, no movement, like she had never been there at all. I stared at the spot where she'd been, my mind racing. I blinked, then I blinked again. The beam of the spotlight was still locked on the swing, but there was no one there. No sign of her. No footprints in the dirt. Nothing. "What the hell?" I whispered, my voice barely audible. Eric's hand tightened on the steering wheel, and I saw his knuckles go white. I could feel the tension in the car, thick and suffocating. "Should we get out and look for her?" I asked, though I don't know why I even said it. I think I just wanted to do something, anything to make sense of it. Eric didn't respond at first. His gaze never left the park. His voice was low, barely a whisper when he finally spoke. "Hell to the no." And that was it. Without another word, he put the car in reverse and drove off. Slowly at first, like he wasn't sure what he had just seen, the park, now completely silent, disappeared behind us as we left. I kept looking back in the rearview mirror, expecting to see her there, standing by the swings, walking into the night, or maybe just staring, but nothing. The road behind us remained empty, the kind of empty that makes you question everything you thought you knew about the world. We didn't talk about it the whole drive back. Neither of us did. I don't think either of us wanted to bring it up. What could we have said? The girl was there, and then she wasn't. There's no logical explanation for that. No sense to be made of it. To this day, I can't explain what happened. It still haunts me. I don't know who that girl was or why she was there. I don't know if she was real or if it was some kind of trick of the mind. But I know one thing for sure. Whatever it wasn't human. Eric and I never talked about it again. We've both been back to Amherst, but I can't go near that park. Every time I drive by, I get this feeling like something's watching me, waiting. I haven't ridden with him on a shift since. Some things you just can't unsee. Some things are better left alone. Story 2. I still remember the first time I took a call from her. I was working late, my shift nearly done when dispatch passed it along. It was a usual kind of call, one that we got at least two or three times a week. The woman would call in the dead of night, every night without fail, claiming that fairies, elves, or some other supernatural force was breaking into her house and stealing her food. At first, it was laughable. My uncle, who'd been with the department for years, would roll his eyes when the call came through. But he'd always go. It was part of the job. Check the scene, reassure the caller, and make sure there were no real threats. He'd been doing it for years, but even he couldn't explain the strange, unsettling calls coming from that house. The woman wasn't dangerous, just deeply paranoid. But that didn't stop the calls from getting to him. Every night, a bizarre ritual that had gotten on his nerves. One night, though, something happened that I couldn't explain. It was close to midnight when I was asked to back up my uncle on one of these calls. The usual patrol car was out, so it was just the two of us. We'd gotten used to her odd behavior, but this time, something felt off. We rolled up to the small, isolated house, the porch light flickering in the darkness. The wind howled through the trees, rattling the old wooden shutters. When we knocked, she answered the door immediately, eyes wide, almost frantic. "They're in there again! They're in there, I swear!" Her voice trembled, hoarse from the constant calls. She led us inside without another word, pointing to the kitchen floor. I looked down and felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It wasn't just a mess, it was an entire scene. Powdered sugar was scattered in wild, chaotic lines across the floor, marking paths that seemed to move with no real purpose. At first, I thought she was just losing it, but the prints were strange, tiny. So small, they looked like they could belong to something other than a human. It made me uncomfortable. "I've been trying to catch them," she whispered, her eyes darting around nervously. "I'm telling you, they're stealing my food. Look at the tracks, you'll see. They're too small to be real." Her hands gripped the edges of the counter as she leaned in, her breath coming faster. The room felt colder now, and I could feel my uncle's unease next to me. He didn't say anything, just knelt down, inspecting the tracks. "Don't touch anything," he muttered to his partner. I noticed his tone had changed, now more serious, more cautious. One of the officers, a guy named Johnson, squatted next to the marks, a flashlight in hand, trying to get a better look. "What the hell kind of animal makes prints like that?" he muttered under his breath. "I've never seen anything like this in my life." The room went silent. The officers were all exchanging confused glances, murmuring. I felt an eerie pressure in the air, like we weren't supposed to be there, like we were intruding on something unnatural. We've checked this place before, my uncle said, standing up. No sign of a break-in, no forced entry. So what the hell is this? His voice was tight, and I could tell he was starting to feel the strain too. Just as we were about to talk about what to do next, the back door slammed open with a sudden gust of wind, and I saw movement in the shadows, something small and quick, darting across the floor. My heart skipped a beat. There was a sudden collective gasp. A few officers took a step back, as if preparing for something to leap out at us. Did you see that? Johnson whispered. Before I could respond, a second figure, smaller, darted across the floor, then another. The tiny creatures moved too quickly for us to identify, but there were more of them now. My uncle shaved.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
NASCAR on Prime is gearing up for the tricky triangle at Pocono. After 5 decades of racing tradition, it's clear that strategy is king at Pocono. 3 legendary turns, 3 unique approaches. Who will tame the triangle this year? Don't miss the Cup Series at Pocono, streaming today at 1 p.m. Eastern. NASCAR, it's on Prime.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get 2 select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Taking his head, ordered us to clear the kitchen. We rushed back toward the door, trying to assess what we were dealing with. But the prints, those tiny tracks in the sugar, seemed to be multiplying right before our eyes. There were more of them than we'd realized. The air felt heavy. I could hear my uncle's voice trembling as he radioed in for backup. The feeling of dread in that house was unlike anything I'd experienced in my career. The sense that something was watching us, something that didn't belong. We didn't find any more movement at first, but when we went back into the kitchen, the tracks were different, more defined, as though something had been through just moments ago. The wind outside picked up again, and I felt a chill crawl down my spine. It was Johnson who noticed it first. He had pulled out his camera, snapping a few shots of the strange footprints, but now he was staring at something else on the floor. His hands shook as he pointed to a small, wriggling pile of fur in the corner. That wasn't there before, he whispered. In a flash, we realized that the prints weren't from elves or fairies or whatever the woman had been imagining. There were tiny, fur-covered creatures huddling in the corner of the kitchen. They weren't moving in a pattern that was normal, and there were so many of them, so small, so fragile. I'll never forget the moment we realized what it was. A baby possum, the size of a rat, but covered in soft fur and with those beady eyes. It was crawling slowly across the floor, followed by another, then another. There were more than I could count. My heart raced as I looked around at my fellow officers. The kitchen felt like it was full of them now. More possums, more babies, sneaking in from wherever they were hiding. That's impossible, Johnson said, his voice barely above a whisper. How could they? My uncle's face went pale. The tracks, he muttered. The tracks are from the babies, but we never saw them before because the mother carries them. She must have had them recently. They're moving around on their own now. We rounded up the tiny creatures, each one smaller than a fist, and took them outside. The woman watched us from the doorway, her eyes wide with disbelief as we released the possums into the woods nearby. We made sure she knew that they weren't some mystical beings, just creatures looking for warmth and food. and we reassured her for the umpteenth time that there was no one breaking in. As we left, my uncle turned to me. His face was pale, and I could see the stress in his eyes. "I've been to that house more times than I can count," he muttered, "and I've never seen anything like that." Neither had I. The image of those tiny creatures, their tracks etched in the sugar, still haunts me to this day. I don't know what I was expecting that night, but it wasn't that, and I don't think I'll ever truly understand what happened in that house. Story 3. I'm not easily spooked, especially after years of working in small towns like Amherst. When you're out on calls at midnight, you get used to dealing with oddities. But that night was different. Something about it felt wrong from the very start. I was working as a deputy when the call came in. The voice on the other end was frantic, high-pitched, trembling with fear. It was a woman in her late 70s or 80s, calling about strange noises coming from her front door and garage. She was in the middle of the woods, far out of town, no neighbors for miles. At first, I thought it was just a confused call. Maybe she was hearing things in the wind. But she sounded terrified, so I couldn't ignore it. I geared up and headed out. The roads were quiet, almost eerily so. The further I drove, the darker it got. By the time I reached her place, I could barely see anything but the narrow strip of headlights cutting through the trees. The house was a small cabin, nestled in the middle of the forest, far from the nearest road. No lights on, not a sound, just the soft hum of the engine in my car and the trees swaying in the breeze. I knocked on the door, but it swung open before I even touched it. She was there, skinny, hunched over, her hair wild and unkempt. Her eyes were wide, glassy, like she hadn't slept in days. Her clothes were loose, and she was holding something in her hand, what looked like a weathered old walking stick. But it wasn't the walking stick that got me. It was her voice. "They're out there," she whispered, her words barely audible. "They're in the woods. I can hear them, banging on the door. And the garage. Don't you hear it?" I hadn't heard anything. I tried to stay calm, reassured her that I was here to help. I asked her to show me what had happened. She clutched my arm and whispered in my ear, "The shed. You have to check the shed. They're in there." I didn't know what she meant by they, but I wasn't about to dismiss her. The woman was clearly disturbed, but I needed to know more. So I nodded and followed her as she led me to the back of the house. The air was heavy, colder now. The trees around the property were so thick, it felt like the entire world had faded away. She pointed to a large shed in the distance. It wasn't the kind of shed you'd expect someone to have out here. It was old, wooden, with a rusty padlock on the door. The woman's voice cracked as she spoke. "They're in there, waiting." I felt a chill crawl down my spine. I didn't want to look inside, but she was insistent, so I made my way over to the shed. The grass was damp beneath my boots, the crunch of leaves the only sound as I approached. I hesitated before reaching for the latch. Every instinct in my body told me to turn around, to leave, but I couldn't. I had to know what she was so afraid of. The shed door creaked open with a loud groan. The smell hit me first, a mix of mildew, dust, and something. Something else. My flashlight flicked on, and I slowly scanned the interior. At first, I thought it was just a bunch of old furniture, maybe some forgotten belongings, but then I saw them. Dolls, hundreds of them. They were sitting upright, lined up on shelves, staring at me with their cold glass eyes. Big, unsettling eyes. Each one was maybe 2 or 3 feet tall, their faces cracked, their clothes torn and dirty. There were so many of them. The entire shed was filled with them. Dolls, some of them almost lifelike, others grotesque in their distortion. They were all facing the door. I stepped back, heart pounding in my chest. "What the hell is this?" I muttered under my breath. The woman's voice came from behind me, soft but urgent. "They watch. They watch me. Every night." My eyes darted around the room. The dolls were arranged in a perfect row, sitting as if waiting for something. I could feel the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Something was wrong. I'd seen odd things before, but this felt different. I turned to look at her, and there was something in her eyes, something off, a glimmer of satisfaction. But it wasn't joy. It was something darker. She watched me, her lips curling into a tight smile, her gaze flickering back to the shed. "Don't you hear them?" she asked, her voice low now, almost a hiss. I froze. There was a soft sound from inside the shed, like a creak or a shift. It wasn't the wind. It was too deliberate, too distinct. My hand tightened around my flashlight. I swung it around the room again, searching for the source. The dolls didn't move. They couldn't. I tried to shake it off. "It's just the house settling," I said, forcing my voice to sound steady. But deep down, I didn't believe it. Then the banging started. First, it was faint, like a thud, coming from somewhere inside the shed. Then louder, more distinct. The sound of wood on wood, followed by a scrape, like something was dragging across the floor. My breath hitched. I swung the beam of light back across the room, but nothing had changed. The dolls still sat there, staring at me with those empty, soulless eyes. "Get them out," the woman said, her voice rising. "They don't like it when you're here." I stepped back, my pulse racing. I couldn't understand what she meant. I was about to tell her that she needed help, but before I could say anything, one of the dolls moved. It was the one in the front. It twitched. Its arm jerked up, and the head turned toward me, slowly, deliberately. I staggered back, heart hammering in my chest, nearly tripping over my own feet. The woman's laughter echoed behind me, soft and manic. "They're awake now." I didn't even think. I ran. I bolted back toward the house, not looking back until I was inside, slamming the door behind me. I never went back to that shed. Story 4. I'm a cop. My partner and I were dispatched on a routine welfare check, or at least that's what it should have been. We had a call about an elderly man, 72 years old, who hadn't been seen in days. The neighbors hadn't seen him, the mail was piling up in his box, his car hadn't moved, and he'd missed a doctor's appointment. No one was worried at first, but after a few days, they started to get concerned. The call came in as a possible medical emergency, but we both knew what it meant. We were about to find a body. We pulled up to the house, a small, rundown place on the edge of town. A weathered old house, the kind you see in forgotten neighborhoods. The windows were dark. The mailbox was stuffed with letters. Something about it gave me the creeps right away. I could tell my partner was already in that same mode. The one where you know something's off, and it's only a matter of time before things go south. My partner, Corporal Jansen, was a guy who had seen it all. He'd been in the department for over a decade and had been to hundreds of welfare checks, most of them uneventful. But you could see the weariness in his eyes. He'd seen things that would keep most people awake at night. And today, I could feel the unease too. "All right, you take the lead," he said, pulling rank. "I'll follow you." I nodded, though I wasn't sure I liked the sound of that. Something told me today was going to be different. I took a deep breath and made my way up the creaky porch steps. My hand hovered over the door handle. The door was unlocked. We both exchanged a look, but Jansen gave me the silent signal to open it. I turned the knob slowly, and as soon as the door creaked open, a smell hit me. It was thick, overpowering, something I'll never forget. It was a mix of rot, decay, and something metallic. The air in there was wrong. It didn't take long to know what we were walking into. I stepped inside, and my heart started racing. The floor was covered in dust, but something caught my eye. There, on the living room floor, was a body. Well, it looked like a body. It was a foot sticking out from behind a couch. My stomach sank. I knew what that meant, but I couldn't let myself believe it. Jansen stood in the doorway, his hand resting on his gun. I knew he could feel it too. It was too quiet, too still. We both knew that the man we were supposed to be checking on was dead. There was no way he was still alive after days of not being seen. The air in the room felt like it was holding its breath. "Go check," Jansen ordered. I was the rookie. It was my job to make sure things were official, so I stepped closer to the body. I tried to keep my hands steady as I crouched down beside him, but as I looked closer, the details started to register. His skin was pale, almost ashy. His limbs were stiff, and the veins on his legs were dark, swollen. Liver mortis had already set in, a clear sign he'd been dead for some time. His mouth was open slightly, dried saliva around the edges. A sickening sight. He hadn't moved in days, it was obvious. I swallowed hard, trying to steady myself, and I placed two fingers on his neck, checking for a pulse. My fingers barely brushed his skin when he took a deep breath. My entire body froze. Time stood still for a second. I jerked back, my heart pounding in my chest. For a split second, I thought I was hallucinating. But no, he wasn't dead. His chest rose again. Slowly, a deep, ragged breath. He shifted, and with a groan, he rolled over, his eyes blinking open. "What the hell?" I whispered, my voice barely audible, shock paralyzing me. The old man's eyes opened, and they were wide with confusion. "What are you doing in my house?" he asked, his voice scratchy, like it hadn't been used in days. I stumbled backward, tripping over my feet, and I swear to God, I thought my heart was going to stop. I couldn't breathe, couldn't process what was happening. Jansen was screaming behind me. I couldn't look back at him, couldn't move, couldn't even speak. "Oh, shit," I heard him yell. The man on the floor didn't seem to notice, just lay there staring at me like it was any other day. My mind was racing. How was he still alive? There was no pulse when I checked. He had to be dead. I had seen the signs. Lividity, rigor mortis, everything pointed to death. And yet here he was, breathing, blinking at us as if nothing had happened. I finally found my voice, my mouth dry. We need help now. Call EMS. I barely registered what I was saying, my hands fumbling for my radio. Jansen was already ahead of me, radioing in for an ambulance. His voice was shaky, his usual calm replaced by panic. He was trained, but even he was rattled. "Is he alive?" the dispatcher asked. But I couldn't answer. How could I? The man who was supposed to be dead had just rolled over and asked why we were in his house. The things I saw, I don't know how to explain it. I heard the sirens in the distance. I should have felt relieved, but all I could think about was how wrong everything felt. When the EMS arrived, they worked on him. The old man didn't move. He didn't respond when they tried to check his vitals. No pulse, no blood pressure. "He's gone," one of the paramedics said grimly. "He shouldn't be alive." But somehow he was. Somehow, against every rule of medical science, he was still breathing. They transported him to the hospital, but by the time they arrived, the man was dead again. The doctors confirmed it. There was no pulse, no blood pressure, nothing. I can't explain it. I've been on this job long enough to know what I saw, but this wasn't normal. Something happened in that house that day, something I can't put into words, something I don't ever want to experience again. I haven't been able to sleep right since. Every time I close my eyes, I see his face, still confused, still alive, when there's no way he should have been. And the worst part, we never found an explanation for it. Story 5. I live in a small, quiet neighborhood in the outskirts of town, nestled between old oaks and dead-end streets. It's the kind of place where people leave their doors unlocked and neighbors know each other's business. But that night, everything changed. It was a Wednesday, late in October, just past midnight when the phone rang. 911, what's your emergency? I answered, already expecting the usual late-night drunk calls or missed dials. There was a long pause before a shaky voice came through the line. There's someone outside, she whispered, barely above a breath. I saw a shadow, lurking in my backyard. Can you send someone? I don't feel safe. I'm all alone. I tried to keep my voice steady. Ma'am, where are you calling from? My address is... She rattled it off, but her voice cracked, and the next few words were drowned out by her sobs. I quickly dispatched the nearest units. We'll have officers with you soon. Stay on the line with me, all right? But she had already hung up. I could feel the tension in my gut tighten as I punched in the coordinates. The house was isolated, tucked away behind tall fences and thick hedges. It wasn't a place you'd expect a break-in to happen, but in my line of work, you never really get used to the unpredictability of things. When the officers arrived, I stayed on the line, listening to the steady beat of their radios and the distant hum of their patrol car engines. The first thing they noticed when they pulled up was that the door to the house was wide open. That wasn't right. The lady had said she was home alone and scared. They didn't even need to knock before stepping inside. Ma'am, one of the officers called, his voice low but firm. Inside, the house was eerily still, the kind of stillness that made the hairs on the back of your neck prickle. She was sitting in a chair, her frail form hunched over, staring at the window, not speaking, just watching. The officer moved closer, his boots creaking on the old wooden floor. "Ma'am, are you all right?" She didn't respond. Her eyes didn't even move. She didn't blink. She just kept staring ahead as if entranced by something in the dark. The officer exchanged a glance with his partner. "I'm going to check the backyard," he said, and they both turned to leave. They stepped outside, scanning the yard, their flashlights sweeping over the well-kept garden and the sturdy high fence. There were no signs of anyone having been there. No footprints, no broken branches. It was almost too quiet. "Nothing," one of them muttered under his breath. But when they walked back into the house, they paused. Something was off. The door had been left open, yes. But there was something else. Footprints. Inside. The first officer's breath caught as his flashlight beam landed on the muddy bare footprints scattered across the living room floor. The prints didn't make sense. There was no sign of forced entry, no windows smashed. These footprints weren't from a visitor who had walked in from the outside. They were too deliberate. The woman, still sitting in the same spot, hadn't moved. I felt a coldness in my chest as I heard the radio crackle in my ear. "Dispatch, we found something." I could barely make out his words, but the panic in his tone was unmistakable. The officers stood frozen, staring down at the prints. One of them took a step forward and pointed at the floor. "These prints, they're coming from inside." I swallowed hard, my pulse quickening. "What the hell? Are you sure?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. "Check again." There was a long pause before the officer spoke again, his voice tight. I'm sure." There was no mistaking it. The footprints weren't outside. They weren't from someone entering the house. They were coming from somewhere inside. They led from the front door to where the woman sat, unmoving, by the window. "Ma'am?" the officer asked gently, kneeling beside her. "Do you know where these came from?" She still didn't respond. Her eyes remained fixed ahead, unblinking. But something in the air had changed. A heaviness settled in the room that was suffocating. "Ma'am, we need you to talk to us." The woman's lips quivered slightly, and for a moment, I thought she was going to speak. But then her voice came, a whisper so quiet, it was almost lost in the hum of the radio. "I wasn't looking outside." The officer leaned closer, trying to make sense of her words. "What do you mean? You weren't looking outside?" She finally turned her head, her eyes locking onto the officer's face, but there was no recognition in her gaze. Her expression was vacant, distant. "I was looking at someone behind me," she whispered. "I thought it was just a shadow, but it moved, and it was inside, not outside." A chill shot through me, making me shiver despite the warmth in the room. The officer's voice was barely a whisper as he responded, "What do you mean, inside?" But she didn't answer. The officer turned toward the other one, their faces pale, their bodies stiff. They both looked as though they were trying to process what she had just said. They looked at the footprints again, tracing the path from the door to the woman, and then they stopped. The prints continued, but they weren't going towards the back door. They were heading toward her. A wave of panic washed over me, and I felt my breath catch. "Get out of there," I barked through the radio. "Get out of the house now." But they didn't respond. I heard a low sound in the background, like someone dragging their feet across the floor. It wasn't the officers. I knew it wasn't. "Get out of there!" I screamed into the radio. There was a sharp intake of breath, followed by a rush of static, and then silence. I didn't hear anything from them after that. The next few hours felt like a blur. More officers arrived at the scene, but by the time they got there, the house was empty. No sign of the woman. No sign of the officers. The only thing left behind were the footprints, leading nowhere. To this day, I can't explain what happened. The woman was never found, and the officers were never heard from again. I know that something was there, something that didn't belong. Story 6. I used to work as an EMT in a small town in northeastern Colorado, a place where everyone knows everyone, and the quiet streets often gave way to the strange events that no one wanted to acknowledge. It wasn't the busiest job, but it was steady. Most of the calls I went on were routine. Chest pain, sprained ankles, the occasional car accident. But every once in a while, something happened that made you question the world around you. It was a late night, nearly 1 a.m. My partner Steve and I were stationed near the local mall. The parking lot was mostly empty, save for a few late-night shoppers and the security guard on patrol. We were in the back of the ambulance, eating some fast food, joking about our last call when the radio crackled to life. Possible pediatric respiratory distress at the mall. Units 5 and 7 respond. The dispatcher's voice cut through the silence. Without hesitation, Steve hit the siren, and we sped through the streets. The mall wasn't far, but it felt like an eternity as we navigated the winding roads in the cold night air. By the time we arrived, there was a sense of urgency in the air. A group of people was standing near the entrance, whispering, some looking over their shoulders like they were afraid of being watched. We pulled up and I could already see a woman pacing back and forth, frantically waving us over. "She's inside, hurry!" she shouted as we rushed out of the ambulance. I didn't get a good look at her, just her messy hair and wide eyes as she ran off toward the entrance. We followed her inside. The mall was eerily quiet for a place usually buzzing with energy, the fluorescent lights casting long shadows across the tiled floor. The woman led us to a small crowd gathered near the food court, and that's when I saw the girl. She couldn't have been more than 8, maybe 9. Her face was pale, her eyes wide with terror. Her breath was shallow, rapid. Her chest heaved as if she was trying to suck in air that wasn't there. But it wasn't the labored breathing that set me on edge. It was the look in her eyes. Something was off about her, something I couldn't explain. "We need to get her out of here now," Steve said, his voice sharp. I nodded, already moving toward the child. The woman beside her, her mother, I presumed, was frantic, mumbling to herself. She kept glancing at the girl, then back at the others who were whispering in the background. There was something wrong here. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I could feel it. "Sweetie, can you tell me what's going on?" I asked the girl as gently as I could. She didn't respond right away, her gaze unfocused, as though she was looking past me at something I couldn't see. "It's the demons," she whispered, her voice so quiet I had to lean in to hear her. "They live in the dark. They're in my house. They follow me." I froze. My skin prickled. I glanced at Steve, who had his back to us, trying to keep the crowd away. There was an unsettling silence between us, a moment where the air seemed to thicken. I shook it off, trying to focus. Kids say strange things sometimes, especially under stress. I couldn't let myself get distracted by her words. "Hey, it's okay," I said, my tone soft, trying to keep her calm. "You're safe now. We're going to help you." But she wasn't listening. Her eyes were locked on something above my head, her chest rising and falling even more erratically. Then, as if in response to her own words, her heart rate dropped. I could feel it in the pulse on her wrist, a steady thrum that slowed, slowed, and slowed more until it was barely there. "Shit," I muttered, looking at Steve. He turned quickly, his face already pale. "Code blue now," he shouted. We moved fast. I could feel the panic setting in, creeping into my own chest. We had to get her out of there. I lifted her into my arms as gently as I could, her body light but tense, like a doll whose strings were being pulled by something unseen. I could hear her breath, shallow, erratic, and my heart hammered in my chest. Something was wrong. This wasn't just a kid having a panic attack. I carried her outside, trying to ignore the growing sense of unease that was building in my gut. The night air hit me as we passed through the doors, but it didn't help. It felt colder, sharper, like I was moving through a dream that didn't belong to me. "Her heart rate's still dropping," Steve called out from behind me. I glanced at the girl, and in that moment, her eyes locked onto mine, and I swear to God I saw something in them, something old, something dark. She wasn't looking at me like a scared child anymore. It was like she was looking through me, like she was seeing something beyond the veil of reality, something I couldn't even begin to understand. "It's coming," she whispered, and then her heart rate plummeted even further. My blood ran cold. There was no time. We had to move faster, get her to the hospital, but every step I took felt heavier than the last. The world felt distant, like it was slipping out of focus. All I could hear was her voice, her words ringing in my ears. They're coming. They never stop. They never leave. I don't know how, but we made it to the ambulance. I laid her on the stretcher, my hands shaking as I hooked her up to the monitors. Her vitals were erratic, like the machine didn't know what to make of her. "Stay with me, sweetie," I whispered. "Stay with me." For a second, there was silence. The steady beep of the monitor was all I could hear, and I prayed for it to stay steady. Then, just as I was about to make the call to the hospital, her breathing evened out. Her heart rate began to rise, slowly at first, and then more steadily. It was as if she'd snapped out of whatever trance she had been in. "We're okay," I said, more to myself than to her. But she just looked at me, her expression unreadable. And that's when she said it, in that same haunting, whispering voice. "They'll be waiting." I didn't know what she meant. I didn't want to know. We got her to the hospital, and by the time we arrived, she was stable. Her vitals were normal. But I'll never forget that look in her eyes, or the feeling of them, whatever they were, lingering in the air, like they were still watching. The hospital staff had no explanation for her sudden collapse and recovery, but I didn't need one. I knew exactly what I'd seen. Story 7. It was late summer, one of those nights where the air still held the heat of the day, but the wind whispered promises of cool relief. The moon was full, but that didn't do much to light up the vast emptiness around us. I was in the passenger seat, my partner at the wheel. Both of us headed down a desolate stretch of two-lane highway, somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. This wasn't a place you'd find yourself unless you had to be there. No streetlights, no houses, just endless, dark fields and the occasional cluster of trees. We'd been called out to a remote farm. Someone had a health issue. It wasn't unusual for us to get calls like this. But what was unusual was the drive out there. The roads were winding, twisting, and nearly pitch black. I was trying to keep my mind off of it, focusing on the white lines that passed by and the steady hum of the engine. We approached a sharp right turn, and that's when I saw it. A man, or at least what I thought was a man, moving across the field to my left. He was going at a speed that didn't seem right, almost like he was gliding, but not quite like running. There was no up and down motion like you'd see with someone sprinting. It was as if he was on a bike, but I couldn't see one. It was the kind of movement that made your mind try to rationalize what you were seeing, but something didn't quite fit. For a moment, I just watched, trying to make sense of it. We were on a winding road and I could barely see through the side window. But the way this man moved, smooth and fast across the uneven ground, it was wrong. The figure continued toward a cluster of trees. By the time we got closer, I saw him stop at the base of one of the larger trees, his back turned toward us. My eyes darted from him to the road. My partner was focused on the curve ahead. I could feel my pulse start to pick up as we got closer, my instincts telling me something wasn't right. The man didn't turn his head, didn't move, just stood there, perfectly still, like he was waiting, or maybe watching. It wasn't until we were almost past him that I turned my head to look. The glow from the headlights barely illuminated the area around him, but enough for me to catch something that froze me in place. The man was standing there. No bike, no motion. Just standing there, his eyes fixed on the truck as we passed. He didn't blink, didn't flinch. He just stared at us, like we were nothing more than a passing shadow. My heart hammered in my chest as I turned back to the front. My breath hitched. The hairs on the back of my neck were standing up, a cold shiver running down my spine. I couldn't explain why, but I felt like we were being watched, but not in the way you'd expect. It was more like we were intruding on something, something we shouldn't have seen. We kept driving, the silence stretching out between us. I could hear the faint hum of the tires against the asphalt, the only sound in the truck. My partner didn't say anything at first. He was focused, keeping his eyes on the road, but I could feel the tension thick in the air, like something was about to break. Finally, I couldn't hold it in anymore. "Did you see that guy?" I asked, my voice tight, the words tumbling out faster than I intended. There was a long pause, just the sound of the engine, before he responded. His tone was slow, unsure, like he was piecing things together. "Man, I thought I was crazy." He went quiet for a moment, and I could hear the wheels turning in his head. You saw him too, right? He added, almost as if he was asking for confirmation. I nodded, though I wasn't sure if that was the answer I wanted. Yeah, I saw him. He was just standing there watching us. We both fell silent again, the weight of it settling over us. I could feel the unease in the air. It wasn't just the weirdness of the situation. It was something deeper. Something about that man, if he was even a man, was off. Like we'd stumbled upon something we weren't supposed to. I looked out the window, my eyes scanning the darkness outside, hoping for some sign of normalcy. But it was just empty fields, a few scattered trees, and then more darkness. I couldn't shake the feeling that we weren't alone, though. Not in the way you expect in a rural area at night. This wasn't loneliness. It was something else. We reached the farm eventually, but the call felt like an afterthought, a blur. I don't even remember what happened when we got there. I don't remember any of the details except the feeling that we were being watched, that cold, suffocating sensation that lingered even when we were inside the house, doing what we were trained to do. The drive back felt different. The same stretch of winding road, the same fields, the same darkness. But something had shifted. The night felt heavier, and the silence between us felt more oppressive. We didn't talk much. Neither of us wanted to break the quiet, to put words to the unease that still clung to us. It wasn't until we were almost back in town that I couldn't stand it anymore. "You still thinking about that guy?" I asked, my voice barely above a whisper, like I didn't want to say it out loud. He nodded, his eyes straight ahead, but his grip on the steering wheel had tightened. "Yeah," he muttered, his voice low. "I can't stop thinking about it. That wasn't right." I didn't respond. Didn't know what to say. We both knew it, felt it deep in our bones. Whatever we'd seen out there, it wasn't just some random person in the middle of nowhere. It wasn't something that could be explained away with a simple answer. The way he moved, the way he just stood there watching us, it wasn't human. Not in any way I could understand. By the time we got back to the station, I couldn't shake the feeling that something had followed us, something had seen us, and it wasn't done with us. I haven't been able to get it out of my mind since, but I don't talk about it much. Who would believe me? Who would believe that we saw something out there, something that wasn't supposed to be, something that shouldn't have been able to move so smoothly, so quickly, and just stand there, watching? Story 8. I used to be an EMT in a small suburban town, the kind of place where you could leave your doors unlocked at night and everyone knew your name. It was a Saturday afternoon, clear skies, nothing out of the ordinary. That was until we got the call. A cyclist had hit a car head-on. When we pulled up to the scene, the first thing I noticed was the silence. There was no crowd gathered around, no rubberneckers standing at the curb staring in morbid curiosity. The street was empty. A few cars passed by, but it felt like the whole neighborhood had suddenly decided to go into hiding. That alone struck me as odd. Accidents like this, violent ones, the kind you know will have blood and broken bones, always draw attention. Always, but not this time. We found him lying in the middle of the road. His bike was tossed off to the side, wheels still spinning. It was like something out of a horror movie, the way the street stretched out so empty and quiet around him. He wasn't moving, and there was blood pooling beneath his head. I had seen a lot of injuries before, but this was different. His skull had caved in, like a watermelon that had been dropped from a height. His eyes were wide open, unblinking. He wasn't just knocked out, he was out. I felt a wave of dread hit me as I approached him. Despite the mess, I tried to remind myself that we could fix this. People survive head injuries all the time. But this was something else. The damage was catastrophic. His skull was fractured so badly, I couldn't even make sense of how it could have happened. My partner, Brad, was kneeling next to him, his hands hovering over the man's chest. I could see the uncertainty on his face as he checked for a pulse. I started unloading our gear, keeping my eyes on the man's face, watching for any sign of life. It was like waiting for a clock to tick down to zero. Nothing. "Brad, is he?" I asked, my voice trailing off as I checked the man's injuries. The blood was everywhere, a sickening contrast to the calm, sunny day. Brad didn't respond right away. He was focused, feeling the pulse in the man's neck with more intensity than I had ever seen him use before. After what felt like an eternity, he stood up. His face was pale, like he had seen a ghost. He opened his mouth to speak, but nothing came out. I was about to ask him again when something I'll never forget happened. The man jerked upright. It wasn't a groan or a twitch. He didn't even try to push himself up with his arms. He just jumped to his feet like someone who had been sitting down for a long time and suddenly stood up without any effort at all. It happened so fast I barely had time to process it. He didn't seem to notice us. He looked around, his eyes locked onto his bike like it was the only thing in the world. Blood dripped from his head as he staggered toward it. I could hear my heart pounding in my ears, a sharp contrast to the eerie silence around us. "Wait, wait!" I yelled, instinctively reaching out to stop him. I wanted to grab him, to pull him back down, to do anything. But the guy was on a mission. His legs moved with an unnatural urgency, his body swaying slightly but somehow still upright. I tried to approach him from the side, but the moment I stepped closer, he darted off into the woods. He didn't even look back. Brad stood there, frozen, his mouth hanging open. He wasn't even trying to process what had just happened. He was just staring, eyes wide. "He had no fucking pulse, man," he muttered, his voice barely above a whisper. I wasn't sure I heard him right. "What?" I asked, more out of disbelief than anything. Brad turned to me, shaking his head slowly. "I swear he had no pulse. Nothing. I couldn't feel a damn thing." We both stood there, trying to make sense of it. My mind was racing, but it was like trying to catch smoke with bare hands. The guy was dead. He had to be. There was no way he could have gotten up like that. We'd checked for a pulse. We'd seen the damage. I had seen the blood and the jagged edges of his skull. There was no way. But somehow there he was. I don't know how long we stood there. I'm not sure if it was seconds or minutes, but it felt like time had stopped. Brad and I exchanged a look, neither of us speaking. We were both thinking the same thing. This wasn't normal. We called for backup, more EMS, and a search and rescue team. I tried to stay calm, keep things in order, but the unease in my gut kept building. Something was wrong, horribly wrong. This wasn't just an accident. This wasn't just a freak incident. I couldn't shake the feeling that we had witnessed something otherworldly. The authorities arrived quickly, but by then, the man was long gone. They organized a search party and scoured the woods, but we never heard if they found him. I wasn't sure I wanted to know. I wish I could tell you that I saw the man again, or that I got some explanation. But I never did. Brad and I never spoke about it again, not directly. We just carried on with our jobs, the normal calls, the routine. But every time I hear the screech of tires or see a cyclist zooming by, I can't help but think of him. Was he dead? Was it some kind of miracle? Or was it something else? Something darker? Something that doesn't make sense? I don't know. I don't think I'll ever know. Story 9. I've been working in Quincy for years, but I'll never forget that night. It's not like I expect something supernatural to happen when I'm on shift, but after what happened, I can't shake the feeling that maybe I've seen something I wasn't meant to. It was just past 2 a.m. when the call came in. An emergency dispatcher said they had a weird call. Someone had dialed in but didn't say anything, just left the line open. Standard procedure. We get calls like that all the time. People trying to get attention, kids messing with the system. Nothing unusual, but something about this call felt different. I could hear the static, the crackle on the other end of the line when the dispatcher passed the details. The address was in a rundown part of town, an area where things go quiet after dark. I was with my partner, Rick. We were assigned to check out the address. No big deal, just a well-being check. It was a small, abandoned house. Looked like it had been empty for years, maybe longer. It had one of those long driveways that made you feel like you were already halfway to the next block by the time you reached the door. And when we got there, it was worse than I expected. The place was pitch black. No lights, no movement inside. It was as if the house wasn't even alive. Rick and I exchanged glances, knowing we'd have to go in. The police and fire teams were there already, checking the perimeter. We figured we'd go in, make sure no one was hurt or trapped, and be on our way. but the whole place felt wrong the moment we stepped foot on the driveway. I remember walking up the steps, the old wood creaking under my boots, and that's when the air seemed to shift. It wasn't cold, but it felt thick, like the atmosphere was pressing down on us. We knocked, then tried the door. No answer. Rick used his shoulder to push it open. The door didn't resist, which was strange for a house that seemed so run down. Inside, the darkness was like a wall. Even with our flashlights, it was hard to make sense of the place. The walls were bare, the floor covered in dust. But what stood out the most was the silence. It wasn't like a typical abandoned house where you'd hear creaks or drips. This place was suffocatingly still. We checked the first and second floors. Empty. The place had clearly been left behind. Firefighters were checking the upstairs bedrooms, but the air felt colder. I couldn't shake the feeling that someone was watching us, even though I knew it was just us in there. Rick didn't seem bothered by it, but I could tell he wasn't entirely comfortable either. He kept glancing around, tapping his flashlight nervously. Finally, the basement. That was our next move. The fire crew was already looking around upstairs, and we figured we'd cover the lower level. I opened the basement door, and it creaked so loudly that I thought the whole house would collapse. The stairs seemed endless. We moved carefully, one step at a time. There was something about the way the darkness swallowed the beam of my flashlight that made it feel deeper, like the basement was never really meant to be seen. As we descended, the chill in the air grew stronger. I thought it was just the damp, musty smell of the old house, but it was something more. The air was oppressive, as if the house itself was holding its breath, waiting. At the bottom of the stairs, Rick and I split up, each shining our lights around. Nothing. Just shelves covered in old boxes, broken furniture scattered across the floor. And then, just as I moved deeper into the room, I felt it. A chill, sharp, like ice running down my spine. At first, I thought it was just a draft, but it wasn't. It was as if the temperature had dropped in an instant. I could see my breath. That's when Rick screamed. I spun around, my heart in my throat. He was standing near the back of the basement, his flashlight pointing straight down at the floor, his face pale. "What happened?" I shouted, trying to steady my breath. I felt something," Rick stammered. "Something grabbed me. It was cold and it was like fingers digging into my arm." I turned to look around the basement. There was nothing there. I could see the entire room from where I stood, and there wasn't a soul around. The chill still hung in the air, like a thick fog. Rick didn't wait. He bolted up the stairs, knocking me out of his way. I was so freaked out, I couldn't even move. I just stood there for a moment, trying to process what happened. Then I felt it too. Something behind me, a weight pressing in from all sides, like the house itself was alive and trying to suffocate us. I rushed up the stairs, following Rick out of that basement as fast as I could. Once we were out in the front yard, everything was silent. No sirens, no radio chatter, just the quiet rustling of leaves in the wind. The whole team was outside now, the police, fire, and dispatchers. Everyone was standing around, like they were waiting for something to happen. That's when the fire chief spoke up. "Anyone else feel that chill?" We all looked at each other, nodding. Everyone had felt it. Everyone had been unnerved, but no one could explain what happened. We didn't go back in. It didn't matter what the dispatcher said about needing a follow-up. No one was willing to go near that house again. The calls didn't stop, though. A few hours later, we got another. Same address, same no answer, just the dial tone. But no one went in that time, not even the cops. I'm telling you, I've seen some strange things in this job. I've been to murder scenes, fires, you name it. But that house, it wasn't a typical call. There was something in there, something we weren't meant to see. Story 10. It was a cold, damp night, just past 3 a.m. when we got the call. EMS, report of blood everywhere in a shared house. Police were already on the scene and had requested assistance. The caller, a man who sounded more irritated than alarmed, had reported blood on the walls, staircase, and kitchen. He mentioned an upstairs tenant he thought was dodgy, hinting at drugs or something shady. When we pulled up, the house stood under an orange glow of a flickering streetlight. It looked ordinary enough, one of those overcrowded shared houses where everyone minds their own business. I grabbed my kit and met two officers at the front door. "Prepare yourself," one of the officers said. "It's a lot." They pushed the door open and my stomach dropped. Blood. Everywhere. It wasn't just a little smear or a streak here and there. It was splattered up the walls, pooled on the floor, trailing up the stairs. The hallway reeked of iron and something sour. The fluorescent bulb in the kitchen flickered, throwing uneven shadows on the walls. I exchanged a glance with one of the cops. He looked pale. "How is anyone even alive if they've lost this much?" I muttered. Neither of them replied. The blood trail led through the kitchen and stopped abruptly at the back door. The lock was intact, no sign of forced entry. At the front, a small puddle of blood soaked the doorstep, but there wasn't a trail leading away. It was as if whoever had been bleeding had just vanished. The officers and I exchanged nods and started searching. My stomach churned as we went up the stairs, the blood thickening with each step. The dodgy guy's room was the first door we knocked on. "Police!" one of the officers called. "Open up!" There was a moment of silence before a muffled, groggy voice answered. "Yeah, what's going on?" The door creaked open, and there he was, standing in nothing but pajama trousers. He blinked at us, eyes puffy with sleep. No blood on him, no signs of injury. His room was spotless. The cops gave it a thorough search, but there was nothing to find. "You been out tonight?" one of them asked. "No," he said, rubbing his face. "Been asleep since 11. What's all this about?" The officers didn't reply, just moved on. We went door to door, checking every room. Every tenant had the same story. They'd been asleep, hadn't heard or seen anything. No one had blood on them, and no one's room showed any sign of struggle or injury. The only place the blood was visible was in the shared areas. The staircase, hallways, kitchen, and that doorstep. By the time we finished checking the rooms, I was uneasy. The amount of blood we'd seen wasn't just someone got a cut and walked around. It was life-threatening, arterial spray type of bleeding. If it was an animal, it had to be big, but there was no sign of any. It didn't make sense. The cops called in a dog unit. The dog arrived quickly and started sniffing the blood trail, but its behavior was odd. It followed the trail through the house, pausing at the back door and then circling back to the front. When it reached the doorstep, it stopped. The handler encouraged it to keep going, but the dog just whimpered and sat down, refusing to move. The cop muttered under his breath, "What the hell?" I stood there, staring at the doorstep. The blood was fresh, but there was no trail leading away. No signs of anything or anyone leaving the house. The silence in the house felt heavier now, like the walls were holding their breath. One of the tenants, a young guy in his early 20s, came down the stairs yawning. "Are you guys almost done? I've got work in the morning." The officer nearest to him frowned. "You seriously didn't hear anything? Didn't see anyone come or go?" The guy shook his head. "Number I sleep like a log. Didn't even know something was wrong until you lot showed up." I glanced at my watch. Control was buzzing me to head to another call. I didn't want to leave, but there wasn't much more I could do here. I thanked the officers and told them I had to move on. They said they'd do a wider search of the area and file a report. As I packed up my kit and headed for the door, I couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. The house felt too quiet, too still. The tenants, while cooperative, seemed too calm for a scene like this. If I'd woken up to blood all over my house, I'd have been freaking out. But they just seemed detached. I stepped outside, taking one last look at the doorstep. The puddle of blood glistened under the streetlight. No trail, no footprints, no sign of where it had come from or where it had gone. As I drove to my next call, I couldn't stop replaying the scene in my head. I checked the news the next day, half expecting to hear about a body being found nearby. But there was nothing. No murders, no missing persons. It was as if the blood had appeared out of nowhere and meant nothing. I've seen some weird things in this job, but that night sticks with me. Not because of what I saw, but because of what I didn't. It's the unanswered questions that get under your skin. Who bled that much? Where did they go? Why was there no trail? I don't know if it was paranormal or just something beyond my understanding, but I can tell you this. If I'd lived in that house, I wouldn't have stayed another night.
have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.